Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and we're going to talk about the Second Vatican Council, and we're leaving it open to is there a challenge that you've heard about the Second Vatican Council you'd like to address? Maybe there's a challenge that you'd like to make about the Second Vatican Council. And this all comes from the fact that in recent years, there seems to be a more and more kind of visceral objection to the council and even a rejection of the council in some areas. And that's not good. So if you're in that position and you'd like to discuss it, we would love to discuss it with you. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Here to help us do that is Michael Lofton, who is the proprietor of the Reason and Theology podcast, very popular podcast in which he discusses all kinds of issues having to do with the doctrines of the church, the history, the teachings of the church, and gets into some specific areas with regularity. For example, the Orthodox Catholic dialogue, he makes friends that way. And I'm gonna be honest with you, he makes enemies that way. Because if you're gonna stand up for the truth, you're gonna have both. Michael Lofton, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Cy, thanks for having me back on.
Maybe I shouldn't have said enemies. There, you have opponents out there.
Friction, for sure.
Yeah. A little bit of friction. Okay, that wasn't a charitable way to say it. if you want to talk about the Second Vatican Council, give us a call, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Now, do you buy my premise that in recent years we're seeing a more kind of sustained and organized objection to the Second Vatican Council than we had seen in the, say, during the Pope John Paul II years?
I think so. I think especially with the present pontificate, we're starting to see people aggressively moving away from the Second Vatican Council. But this time it's not coming from the left. This time it's coming from an extreme right position in some instances, as well as the left. So we're getting it from both sides.
Right. nobody's happy. One thing you can always say about that is, there were times in the life and ministry of Jesus when nobody was happy, when barely even the apostles hung on. So, that can be kind of a little bit mean, because then you're implying, my position is like the Jesus position. I never like it when people do that. But in this case, you can say it. I'm not saying my position. I'm saying the church's position has become unpopular, and that is all analogous to what happened with Jesus.
That's certainly the case. I'm reminded of John 6, where that's exactly what happened. Jesus preached a hard saying, as it's called, and many, many of his disciples turned away from him at that moment. And you'll note, however, Jesus did not say, "Wait, come back. I'm going to change my teaching." He didn't do that.
No, he did not. But I personally think that the reason he did not is that he's God. And he's not going to change his teaching for someone else. I throw that out there for you.
That's true.
888-318-7884. All right. So you agree with my basic premise, but what's the remedy? The remedy to for example, are there things in the council that need to be rephrased kind of expanded on so that people will have an idea, I can get behind it that way? Are there things in the council that we just need to know better in order to embrace the council?
All of the above. Certainly some things probably do need to be rephrased. Not that in and of themselves they were wrong or misleading, but some things have been misinterpreted. However, the Vatican has done a decent job of clarifying some of those, although I think some additional work could be done there. But in addition to maybe rephrasing things and clarifying things, I'm going with Pope Benedict XVI in his 2005 Christmas address to the Roman Curia, where he emphasized the fact that the main issue right now that we have had with the Second Vatican Council is a failure to really implement the Second Vatican Council per the text. A lot of people gravitate towards what's called the spirit of Vatican II, basically the effectively an idea behind it rather than what the text in fact says. And this idea, conveniently for some people, is going to be one of dissent and departure from the traditional faith. And Benedict wanted to correct that and say, no, if you want to be faithful to the council, you actually need to be faithful to the text itself, not some kind of nefarious spirit that is vague vague and is really at odds with the tradition of the church.
Okay, so I'm going to propose to you something that I don't think it's that controversial, but it's, and I don't mean it in a mean-spirited way, but there are those in the last 60 years about, you know, almost 60 years since the conclusion of the council, who actually have benefited from being somewhat making the council opaque rather than clear. Because where the council wanted to reform, there's some who want to remake. And if you can kind of be unclear about what the council actually said and refer to things like the spirit of the council, well, then you've got a little leg up on remaking the church into something else.
Yeah, but in the case where people do that, and I agree they do that, they're actually going completely against the very purpose of having the Second Vatican Council. If you look at the opening speech of Pope John the 23rd, who opened the Second Vatican Council, he notes in his opening speech, the primary task of the Second Vatican Council is to guard and preserve the deposit of faith, that tradition that has been handed down to us. And then he says, second to that is to present it in a way that the modern man understands. So to guard and preserve, not to change it, but to just simply present it in a way that modern man can understand. That was the purpose of it, not to change or abandon the apostolic faith. So people who try to exploit it for those purposes are completely going against the very purpose of the Second Vatican Council. And so I don't see how they can even call that the spirit of Vatican II. The spirit is the same thing as the text itself, to preserve the tradition of the apostles and to communicate it in the world today.
So what was wrong with the church that we needed that?
I wouldn't say that there's anything wrong as far as the doctrines of the church. However, there was a breakdown in the way we were communicating these things. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, I love the manualists and the manualist tradition, but there was a certain feel to the presentation that we would give to the faith that was pretty cold and distant, and the average person who wasn't trained in theology probably wouldn't benefit very much from. And so what John the 23rd wanted to do is say, look, let's just take the faith that we have. We're not going to modify it, but let's maybe communicate it in a way that your average person who doesn't maybe have a theology degree could benefit from. And that's a great thing. We want to do that.
So maybe we were tending towards presenting the faith as a sort of system of thought rather than a thing born of a person, Jesus Christ, and always related to that person.
That's a good way to put it. And also that we weren't necessarily applying it to our situation today.
Yeah.
We were maybe applying it to a situation that's outdated. With the fact that we have modern society, we're not going to compromise the faith due to modern society, but we do need to recognize that things have changed. And so in the way that we present the one true faith, we're going to have to mold it to modern society in a way that they can understand and appreciate. But that does not mean that we somehow abandon the faith or compromise in any way.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, okay. So every single line filled up already. So I'm going to go to the phones because people want to talk to you about the Second Vatican Council, all right?
Okay.
Michael Lofton from Reason and Theology is our guest, an affiliate apologist here at Catholic Answers. I'm going to say it. He's the longest serving affiliate apologist now at Catholic Answers, and it's been a great boon to us. I think it's Joan in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, listening on Catholic.com. Is that right? Is it Joan?
Yes, I'm Joanne, actually.
Oh, Joanne, I beg your pardon. I read it wrong. Joanne, go ahead with what you have for Michael.
Yes, I'm just in the middle of a wonderful graduate theology program at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. And I just finished a Vatican II course, and there's just some things that are hanging around in my mind. And one is on if you think that Catholics are finding it difficult to make good moral judgments, for example, on abortion and euthanasia that we were just talking about with another speaker, because Gaudium et Spes and Dignitatis Humanae, it sort of puts more priority on the dignity of conscience rather than the dignity of universal norms to make those particular good decisions in our lives. Do you think that, well, we're approaching it with a hermeneutic of continuity, but do you think that there was some parts of the teachings on conscience in those documents that are kind of leading you know, Catholics astray in some way.
I don't have any evidence that that was the intention of the bishops or that anything in the documents themselves would, you know, lend themselves to somebody who wants to emphasize the primacy of conscience over and against the teaching authority of the church. I know some people could, using a hermeneutic of rupture, could maybe read things like that. But frankly, if we take the hermeneutic of rupture, we could read the Old Testament in all kinds of ways that are discontinuous with the New Testament and level plenty of criticisms against the apostles and against Jesus. And so, however, if we're using the hermeneutic of continuity, as it's called, or the hermeneutic of reform, as Benedict put it in his Christmas address, I think that we're going to see, okay, we need to read the Second Vatican Council in light of tradition, not as opposed to it. So again, I don't see anything in the documents themselves that would say, okay, you can ultimately go with what your conscience says on a particular matter of faith and morals over and against the authority of the church. If that's in the Second Vatican Council, I sure haven't seen it, and I would love to see it.
But is that one of those things that is a consequence sort of the way the council was received, that people did start thinking that way, that my conscience is almost like my God?
Some people did receive it that way, but I would say not due to the council itself or the intentions of the fathers who are at the Second Vatican Council, but certainly due to maybe the intentions of those who want to deliberately overturn some things that they weren't appreciative of in sacred tradition, especially Humanae Vitae.
What do you think, Joanne?
Yeah, just one more comment, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
I guess in Veritatis Splendor, St. John Paul II, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he came across as saying something to the effect that the natural law is, or universal norms are subordinated to subjective conscience. He said something to that extent. So I'm just challenging you in saying that there was sort of some type of reference to that, perhaps to that part of the document in Dignitatis Humanae. I think it was number 3 in particular. But that's just some reference that I had come across.
You're saying the way that you read the document, or some people have read the document, is that somehow one's conscience is the natural law is actually subordinate to one's conscience. Did I understand that correctly?
To a more subjective conscience, right? So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, using your subjective conscience would be more important than the natural law or reason or, you know, a Thomist kind of way.
Sorry, Joanne, but for both of you, isn't this? It is a delicate question in the sense that if a conscience is formed in a certain way, you are obliged to follow your conscience. That doesn't mean that your conscience is always right, but you do have the obligation to follow your conscience, so long as you've done everything you can to try to know the true and the good. So it does strike me that this, even apart from a conversation about the Second Vatican Council, is a bit of a nuanced thing, Joanne.
Mm-hmm. It sure is. Yeah, I just thought I'd put it out there, and thank you for your comment.
Well, thank you, Joanne. I don't think there's any doubt that the idea, since the Second Vatican Council, the idea of conscience has been grossly abused in a lot of Catholic literature, in a lot of Catholic commentary. Would you agree with that, Michael?
I do agree, and I also agree with what you said before. And in fact, that's where I was going to go next, because I would say, okay, if a person believes in their conscience that they need to do X, they are obligated to follow their conscience. But let's say X is wrong. Are they still obligated to do it? Immediately speaking, they are obligated to follow their conscience. However, when they have more time, however, to prepare, they do need to better form their conscience. And they also do have and have had the duty of forming their conscience up into that moment. So it is kind of a delicate matter.
Mm. Okay.
Joanne, thank you. I really appreciate the high level of conversation because that's exactly what we need to dig into the Second Vatican Council. There's 1.5 million people on the phones, though, and I have to go to a break. So I will go to that break and get to the – it's 1.5 million. That's what it says right now. Not exactly true. But Joanne, thank you so much. We'll be right back with more. We're discussing the Second Vatican Council with Michael Lofton on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Michael Lofton is our guest. We're talking about the Second Vatican Council, which maybe surprisingly to me, I have to say surprisingly to me, if you had asked me 20 years ago in 2023, would the documents of the Second Vatican Council be more or less controversial? I'd have said less. I thought that the great papacy of John Paul and then the papacy of Benedict, and this was of course before Francis came, it seemed that we were on a trajectory towards kind of digesting and accepting and starting to make progress, but that doesn't seem to be what happened. But pretty much everything that's happened in the last 20 years, I wouldn't have told you that that's what was going to happen. I didn't see most of it coming. I'm no prophet in that way. So this increasing, in some places, hostility, but in more places, suspicion of the Second Vatican Council is the reason for this show today. If you got challenges for the Second Vatican Council, Michael Lofton is here to help us address. The number is 888-318-7884. We're going out of Terre Haute, Indiana. Derek in Terre Haute, listening on Catholic.com. We're glad you're here, Derek. We'll go ahead with your question or comment for Michael.
Hello. I think that many priests do not follow along Second Vatican Council, and they promote pro-choice instead of life. And I think some priests seem to let their parishioners get away with a little too much and still receive the host. I mean, not many, but there might be some of it. And it seems like...
Yep. Let's get a response from Michael, Derek.
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. I do think that that's some constructive criticism that we could offer with some quarters of the church. You did note there from the Second Vatican Council that the Eucharist is the source and summit of our faith. And so if it is, surely we should be handling the sacred host better. And yeah, I do agree that in some instances with various ways of reception, sure, that's probably not being done as best as it should. So I agree with you. I think there's some valid criticism there.
Derek, thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. I mean, I suppose there's nothing again, this might be one of those ones, Michael, where you would say there's nothing in the documents of the council that push us in that direction. It's the reception of the council that has left us with this casual attitude about the Eucharist.
I agree. And I think if you read the first document of the Second Vatican Council, Sacrosanctum Concilium, I think if you read that, which is the document on the reform of the sacred liturgy, I don't think you could come away with an impious or irreverent view of the Sacred Host after reading that.
Derek, again, thank you. I appreciate that. As I said, all lines full. Well, now one line open, 888-318-7884. The number going to South Dakota, where Dan is listening on Real Presence Radio. Dan, go ahead with your question or comment on the Second Vatican Council for Michael Lofton.
Thank you for taking my call. I guess my question is, in light of the way that the council was implemented, and even though we have tried to make some inroads over the last 10, 15 years as to correcting some of the incorrect ways that the council was implemented, do you think that we can get to the point where we are actually implementing according to the documents that were promulgated? The documents are beautiful, and what's in there is really good, but I don't always see that.
I do think that we can get to that point if we better inform ourselves about the documents, and we could start by reading them, because I often hear from some people who are pretty high up in the church and should certainly know the documents of the Second Vatican Council, and they'll say things and attribute it to Vatican II, and certainly Vatican II did not justify those things. So it just shows that there's a lack of awareness in actually reading the primary sources, that is the text itself. And this isn't just a deficiency on part of maybe some who are in leadership. It's also on part of those who are, you know, just your average faithful and laity. I think all of us need to be better informed about Vatican II. The more we do that, the less it's going to be used to justify abuses.
But Dan, does that satisfy you?
Yeah. I'm just, you know, that's just a curiosity thing.
I wonder how.
I am one that has read all the documents, but I just don't see it implemented the way it. I mean, we went way south in the beginning.
I think over a period of time, however, we could have a sufficient implementation. I think of some of our other ecumenical councils in the past. They took a very long time to implement. I think of the reception of Nicaea I, our first ecumenical council. That was certainly a disaster. Not that the council was a disaster, but perhaps the reception of it was. And it took a while before we really received it. In fact, we had to call another ecumenical council to kind of receive the first ecumenical council.
That's why we got number two. Dan, I thank you very much. I wonder, though, do you have any thoughts on how? Like, should we be, you know, encouraging pastors to do study groups on these documents? Or, like, I don't even know if you can trust some Catholic universities to teach the documents, but others would do a brilliant job on it. But how are we going to get people to know what's actually in those documents? I'm asking you, Michael.
Oh, I thought you were asking the caller. Okay, no. I apologize. I was eagerly awaiting an answer.
I know you looked like you were eagerly waiting. Oh, I can't wait to hear what Dan has to say about this.
I didn't hear what he was going to say. Yeah, I mean, well, what Benedict really emphasized, again, going back to that 2005 Christmas address, was, again, becoming more familiar with the text itself. I do think that you had some good suggestions there. Maybe perhaps have the parish priest who goes over and gives a presentation on them, or perhaps somebody who's well-trained on the local level. That certainly would help.
Yeah, it would. Maybe that's something we could do better at Catholic Answers. I don't know. We have to think about that, about helping to present the documents of the Second Vatican Council. Because, as I said, there is some hostility to them, but there's even more painful in some ways is the broad suspicion. Rather than the pockets of hostility, it's the broad suspicion about the council that's worrisome.
That's true. And you know, I have seen some people where they're starting to do classes on Vatican II, explaining the documents of them, and they're obviously doing them from an Orthodox perspective. So I think that's pretty helpful as well. And they're making them available online.
Dan. Thank you, Dan, very much. Alex is next in Texas, watching on YouTube. Alex, go ahead with your question or comment on the Second Vatican Council for Michael Lofton.
Just had a question about communion. So, you know, obviously pre-Vatican II, we, you know, took communion, we'd kneel, and the priest would then place it on your tongue. It seemed like it was a pretty efficient way of doing it, you know, and it also respected Jesus in the Eucharist. I just was wondering why we went to placing it in the hand when it seems like it could cause a lot of issues, either with someone like sneaking and desecrating the host, mm-hmm. or, you know, it's just like the thought of putting Jesus in our hands, you know, it's a little weird to me. I'm having trouble here. Maybe y'all guys could help me out with it.
Yeah, there's much to be said here. Well, first, there's nothing in the Second Vatican Council that mandates communion on the hand. However, it is within the authority of the Church to mandate that post the Ecumenical Council, which it did allow for. It doesn't necessarily require it. It does allow you to receive either kneeling and on the tongue or on the hand in the Roman Rite. In fact, you have a right to receive either way in the Roman Rite. However, I will say this, even though I personally think the best mode of reception in the Roman Rite right now, due to our circumstances and our circumstances, people are often very irreverent in their mode of reception. I do think kneeling on the tongue is preferred, but I guess when we come on the other
can we do it on
break,
the, yeah.
I'll finish up there. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Alex, hang on, because Michael heard the music, and he was right. We have to take this break. We can't get out of this one. But we'll come back and talk more about the reception of the Eucharist and how that has changed since the Second Vatican Council. We're talking about the Second Vatican Council with Michael Lofton. Your call's welcome. 888-31-TRUTH.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Catholic Answers Live is 25 years old. That's a quarter century helping people come into deeper communion with the Catholic faith. As we move into our second quarter century, please help us reach thousands more by becoming a Society 315 monthly donor. Right now, when you join Society 315 at a monthly giving level of $25 or more, we've added some extra perks to the other great benefits we already offer members. Go to givecatholic.com and choose the monthly option to start your donation.
As a child, the great theologian Thomas Aquinas asked, "What is God?" Best-selling author Kevin Vost's new book follows the mature thought of Aquinas in answering that question. In clear and approachable fashion, "What is God?" examines God's attributes and considers questions about him that have vexed mankind for centuries. Order your copy of "What is God?" today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Janet Benkovic-Williams. There's nothing like Women of Grace to explain the truth of our faith Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Alex is still on the phone from before the break, and Michael is still about to address his question. So we call that a hermeneutic of continuity with what went on before the break. It's not a hermeneutic of rupture with what went on before the break. So Alex is saying, well, you know, this Second Vatican Council changed the way we receive communion. It has led to a kind of irreverence and even a failure to even understand the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Michael, you were addressing that before we just went to the break.
Right. So just to briefly recap, Vatican II did not mandate communion on the hand. In fact, it's not even mandated now. One has the option in the Roman Rite to receive either kneeling and on the tongue or on the hand, with some very, very rare exceptions to that. Now, that being said, I also would note that I do think the best mode of reception right now in the Roman Rite, due to the fact that so many people receive it in a very careless way on the hand, probably would be to emphasize and stress communion on the tongue. So though I may think that that's probably the most prudential way to move forward, I will, however, defend communion on the hand per se, because first of all, it is apostolic. This is the way that the apostles distributed Holy Communion. It's also the dominant form of the first millennium. Communion on the tongue while kneeling was not common, either in East or West. And also in the Eastern tradition today, we tend to use a liturgical spoon that also wasn't the common practice, even in the East in the first millennium. Again, both East and West, the common method of reception was communion in the hand. So there was a reference there about the laity receiving communion. It may feel impious to touch the sacred host. I don't think that that really appreciates the fact, and I know Aquinas, with all due respect, used that argument. I don't think that appreciates the fact that for the first millennium, that was the venerable tradition, and they had no scruples about laity touching the Eucharist. In fact, laity were able to often, in many cases, take the Eucharist home and self-communicate on a daily basis in some instances, even outside of times of persecution. I'm not saying that that's recommended today, but no. What I am saying is I don't think that we can think that these things are intrinsically evil or sinful in and of themselves. So though I may not think that communion in the hand is best way to receive communion today in the Roman Rite practically, I don't want to go to the other extreme and think that somehow there's something wrong with it or it's intrinsically evil.
What do you think, Alex?
That helps out a lot. Thanks, guys. I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I actually didn't know all of that you just said about reception in the hand. I'm one of those, and this has nothing to do with, because I am not a literate person when it comes to liturgy. Just from my personal experience, I have always liked the altar rail. I like to kneel with it seems, as Alex said, both efficient and reverent. It has both qualities. So, but it's fascinating to hear what you just said about, I mean, if the church did something for 1,000 years, you can't turn around and go, well, that's a bad thing to do, because the church didn't do bad for 1,000 years.
Right. And the irony, it's communion kneeling on the tongue that is the innovation. Now,
isn't that interesting?
I'm not saying it's a bad innovation.
Right.
I actually think it's a helpful one, but make no mistake about it, it is an innovation.
Thanks, Alex. Let's go to Heather in Freehold, New Jersey, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Heather, we're very glad you're here. Go ahead with your question or comment about the Second Vatican Council for our guest, Michael Lofton.
Hey, thank you so much. So I think my first question is about ecumenism. I don't understand, why should I even bother being Catholic if all roads lead to salvation, right? If Muslims and Jews and pagans and everybody has a chance at salvation, you know, why would I even bother practicing this religion? And I'll start with that.
Yeah, great question. And if that were true, you would be right to ask, why even bother being Catholic? Fortunately, however, that is not what Vatican II teaches or the Catholic Church teaches. It's very, very clear that there is no salvation outside of Christ Jesus. That's not only in the document Lumen Gentium, it's also in Nostra Aetate and other documents from the Second Vatican Council. And of course, Vatican II had no intention of overturning any infallible teachings, and it is an infallible teaching that there is no salvation outside of Christ Jesus. He's the way, the truth, and the life, and so on and so forth. So I do want to emphasize that. So when we speak of ecumenism, there's a false sense of ecumenism, or there's a false way in which we can speak of it, and there's a true way in which we can speak of it. Unfortunately, when people use the term ecumenism, oftentimes they're not using it in the proper way that the Second Vatican Council uses it or the Church itself uses it. They tend to mean a relativism or a universalism, that I'm okay, you're okay, we're all going to heaven, doesn't matter what you believe. That's what a lot of people think ecumenism means. And that's, again, not at all what Vatican II taught. In fact, if you read Lumen Gentium, starting with paragraph 14, it's explicitly clear. There's no salvation not only outside of Christ, there's also no salvation outside of the Catholic Church. And a person cannot be saved if they refuse to enter or remain in the Catholic Church if they know that this is established by Christ. What gets where people get a little bit hung up and confused is the subsequent paragraphs, 15 and 16, where it begins to speak about Orthodox, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, and then others, maybe Buddhists and Hindus and atheists. And due to misinterpreting some things in there, they think that it's effectively saying, hey, everybody's going to heaven. And I vehemently will defend the opposite thesis from Lumen Gentium itself in the Second Vatican Council.
Heather, what do you think?
Thank you really for that feedback. I'm going to look up Lumen Gentium in paragraph 14 and educate myself on that. If I may, you know, the tangential kind of question comment is, you know, I've heard that there were six Protestant ministers, whatever they are, that were involved in the formation of Vatican II, and why? why did we have
Protestants
involved in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know of some observers, but I don't know of any of them having any kind of meaningful impact on the document. And, you know, having an observer at the council isn't necessarily significant. We've had observers in previous councils before. The question is, do they have voting privileges or influence over the documents? And in this case, no, they don't. By the way, I do have several videos. In fact, I have a Vatican II playlist that you're welcome to watch on my channel, Reason and Theology. Plenty of stuff there. I explicitly go over the issue with Lumen Gentium 14 through 16, if you want to take a look at it there.
Am I correct in saying that the church has invited even excommunicated Christians to councils in the past?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So it's not
invited the Orthodox. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not an innovation. I think it's a mark of Christian charity and a desire for reunion. But Heather, what do you make of that?
I think that there's more homework that I have to do, and so I will check out that playlist. Thank you.
Very, very good. And I think, Michael, you mentioned at the break that there was some good stuff, because Heather just occasioned this conversation, to kind of educate people on Second Vatican Council at Word on Fire.
Yeah, a really good overall view that I've seen was by Dr. Richard DeClue. He puts out a series of lectures on the Second Vatican Council and the documents of them. In fact, he makes them available. It's produced through Word on Fire, but I believe it's available for free, the entire series on YouTube. I know I've seen it before, so I imagine it still is.
I'm going to just zip to the break real quick and get it over with and come back, because we got tons of callers, and I'm looking at these questions of fantastic conversations to come on the Second Vatican Council with our guest, Michael Lofton, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hosting Women Made New has helped me deepen my own faith, and I look forward to every weekend having those in-depth discussions with my guests. It's been such a blessing being a part of the EWTN family and carry on the mission that Mother Angelica started.
Women Made New, Saturday noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. There's just so many good questions and points of conversation. I want to try to get to all of them if I can. It's wonderful to have this opportunity to talk about the Second Vatican Council, kind of talking about challenges to the Second Vatican Council with Michael Lofton today. And I'm going to zip right back to Austin, Texas, where Andrew is listening on our website, Catholic.com. Andrew, we're grateful for the call. Go ahead with your question or comment on the Second Vatican Council for Michael Lofton.
Yeah, actually, this just follows on what you were just talking about. Lumen Gentium 16 explicitly says that the Muslims who professing to hold the faith of Abraham along with us adore the one and merciful God, end quote. How is that not heresy? Because they explicitly deny the Trinity. So I understand that, you know, it's... Anyways, I'd just like to hear you go into some detail on that, because it's there's a lot in there that just seems pretty much explicitly... Well, I'll let you go with it.
Okay, we'll come back to you.
Yeah, there's a lot of angles to come at this from. Let me first note that as far back as John of Damascus in the 700s, he identifies Islam as a Christian heresy.
Right.
I don't know if I would necessarily agree with that anymore. I think it's developed a little bit further beyond being just a Christian heresy at this point that I would classify it as a different religion. But that kind of shows you how some early people saw it. Now, as late as Pope Pius X, who's there in the early 1900s, but obviously before Vatican II, puts in the Catechism of Pius X, exactly that, what you just noted there from the Second Vatican Council, Lumen Gentium 16, that they worship the one God. Now, how do we understand that, and why is that not heresy? It is possible for a person to be oriented in their worship towards the one God and fail to do so for salvation and salvifically. Let me explain that. When we say... you know, outside of the church, there is no salvation. That doesn't necessarily mean that nobody has a proper orientation towards the one God. In other words, if you look at the Jews and the Muslims, they're worshiping the one God of Abraham. However, we would not say that if they're doing so outside of God's grace, that they're worshiping that one God for their salvation, that it's somehow that worship saves them. So salvifically. So we could say that they're oriented in the right direction, but are they hitting the mark? Think of it like a bow and arrow. You can have your bow and arrow pointed towards the mark, and it's right there in the right direction. And they pull the bow, they shoot the arrow, and it doesn't reach the target. It's in the right direction of the target, but it fails to reach it. That's how we would see Muslim worship. It's oriented towards the one God. Together with us, they adore the one God, but their arrow doesn't hit the target, whereas in our case, it does. Much more can be said about that, however. Does that help a little bit?
Andrew?
I mean, it helps a little bit, but, I mean, they explicitly deny the Trinity, so they've been told the truth, and they deny the Trinity, and then I guess my big question is, so much of this is written ambiguously, and it does nothing but bring confusion. When you go back to older councils and older documents, and it was all very clear, and there was no possible misunderstanding of meaning in those older documents.
I would vehemently oppose that tooth and nail. There's no way you could read the ecumenical councils in their acts and come away with that perspective. One of the reasons why we had the second ecumenical council, third ecumenical council, fourth ecumenical council, and fifth ecumenical council is because previous councils had not sufficiently clarified some things, especially in the case of the Fifth Ecumenical Council. It had to tie up loose ends with some confusion, specifically that Chalcedon, the Fourth Ecumenical Council, had on the matter of the three chapters. So there's plenty of ways in which people misunderstood documents in previous ecumenical councils, and it caused all kinds of confusion, and we had to go and clean up the mess from it. This is no different. However, what I would say at the end of the day, What it's saying here about Muslims, is that somehow denying sacred scripture? No, it's not denying anything that you see testified to the truth about the Trinity or the necessity of belief in the Trinity. You mentioned that a lot of Muslims deny the Trinity. A lot of Muslims don't even know what the Trinity is, properly speaking. They actually think that the Trinity might be the worship of three separate gods, or they might think that it's the Father, the Son, and Mary, or something like that. So what they're rejecting in some cases is actually not the worship of the Trinity, but a caricature. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that somehow their worship is salvific or they're in God's grace. It just means that they're oftentimes discarding and pushing back against a caricature.
Sure, but then this begs the point of, then why are we even writing this? You get what I'm saying? Like, why not say it that way? Why not explain, you know, exactly you know, because they have, they do explicitly, I can't quote it, but their books explicitly deny a Trinity. I'm not even going to repeat what it says about it.
Oh, I know.
But
yeah, well, I know. I'm aware.
It compares it to, you know,
to polytheism,
excrement, which is explicitly, you know, blasphemous.
Yeah, but it also identifies the Trinity as Mary, one of the persons of the Trinity. So it's obviously rejecting something that we don't even claim, which is a problem for Muslims in and of itself. But you ask the question, why even do this? Well, first of all, they were very clear in the previous two paragraphs, paragraph 14, that there's no salvation outside of Christ and his church. So they were incredibly, abundantly clear. But unfortunately, that gets often overlooked. But you ask, well, why did they put this in? They tell you the very beginning of paragraph 16. It mentions they are related to us in various ways. Why are they speaking about Muslims being related to us? They're trying to foster good relations. They're trying to say, well, what are some of the positive things we can say about them? We know there's a lot of negative things we can say about their religion. What are maybe some of the positive things that we can say to establish common ground? And once we do that and we establish a rapport, then we can now start to talk about our differences. It's a strategic approach. We might say it hasn't been implemented very well.
Andrew, I'm going to leave it there because, as I said, there's lots and lots of folks with questions about or comments about the Second Vatican Council. I'm going to go now to George in Columbia, Missouri. George, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question or comment for Michael Lofton.
A wonderful topic and a very informed conversation. I was baptized 4 days after the Vatican II Council was implemented on December 8, 1965. And I'm still waiting in my whole life for what the bishops voted on to be implemented in the Western Church. And I just haven't seen it. I've been waiting. And there are just things that were clearly stated in the council documents that Latin would have the pride of place in as a liturgical language, that Gregorian chant had the pride of place. But all I see is anything but that. And if you look at the vital statistics, the number of baptisms, the number of Catholic marriages over time, you just, one has to wonder, where are the fruits of this council? And just can come to the conclusion that I have is that it just hasn't been given to us the way it was intended.
Let's get a response from Michael.
Yeah, I mean, Pope Benedict agrees with you on that. You know, I've mentioned it before. I'll mention it again, the 2005 Christmas address. He does state that there. That we're still waiting on the fruits. In fact, there was also a document 20 years after the Second Vatican Council that also at that time was noting how they still haven't seen the fruits of Vatican II. That is the positive one. So yeah, I agree with you. I think that that's true. I don't know if I would necessarily say that the decline in numbers is necessarily due to Vatican II. It could be related, but I also think that there were other broader issues going on in society that contributed to the decrease in numbers. So I wouldn't necessarily pin it on Vatican II, but I also don't think that Vatican II was necessarily free from all fault as far as its implementation.
Yeah. Okay, George?
Very good. May I make one observation?
Please.
Yes. I appreciated the comment earlier that, you know, what was precious or holy for 1,000 years doesn't suddenly change its nature. And I have gone to the extent of trying to understand Vatican II by going to the Extraordinary Forum and understanding what was in place before so that I could understand why the changes were made. But, you know, I appreciate that I'm, you know, in line with Benedict. God rest his soul.
Amen to that, brother. That's a pretty good line to be in. I'm going to just keep going if it's okay with you, Michael, because I want to try to get everybody on with you.
Yeah, sure.
All right, Albany, New York next. Mike, listening on WOPG in Albany. Go ahead, please, with your question or comment for Michael Lofton.
My biggest concern is the Vatican II popes constantly having these Assisi-type gatherings. Now, the first commandment of God is, thou shalt have no false gods before me. But yet, John Paul II at Assisi and Benedict at Assisi and Francis with Pachamama, and this was never, ever done before Vatican II. Please, show me a pope through the history of the church that did such things. This is a clear manifest, this is manifest heresy. You cannot worship with false religions or offer our Catholic spaces for Buddhists to come in and put a Buddha on our Catholic altars. This is heresy. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. There's no way around it. And the other thing I don't get is, how come, just one more quick point. How are we making all these Vatican II popes saints? We have two pope saints from like Pius V forward, and not all of a sudden we got Paul VI, who is just an absolute mystery how somebody would make him a saint. John the 23rd, John Paul II. Now they're making John Paul the first a saint. It just doesn't make sense. This crush of saints to like justify this heresy.
It's raining saints around here. What's going on, Michael?
Yeah, I think you offer some points that are fair. However, I'd like to fine-tune some of it. I do want to note, I think we're misusing the term heresy specifically, but I get the sentiment of what you're saying, and I agree that there's some valid criticisms here. But again, let me maybe make them a little bit more fine-tuned. You say, when has this ever been done? In fact, there's been done something worse. We have had a pope who was guilty of idolatry in one particular instance. So that has happened before. Now, in the case of Assisi with John Paul II, which I think was a disaster, he himself was not worshiping any false gods or pagan gods or anything like that. However, I do think that there are some legitimate criticisms of that event. You mentioned there a Buddha being placed on the altar. That, of course, was not done with his consent. He never allowed for it. He was sad to even find out that that happened. So obviously, there were some abuses for the intention that was actually supposed to be there. Obviously, some people abused it. I think it was a disaster altogether. Should have just been prudentially avoided because of those very abuses. You also mentioned Pachamama. I'll note, even though, again, I think this is one of those things that incredibly imprudent move, that Pope Francis himself wasn't, you know, worshiping some pagan idol or anything. In the actual Vatican ceremony, they explicitly identify what they're venerating there as Our Lady of the Amazon, that is, the Virgin Mary. We might both agree that that's a very poor depiction of the Virgin Mary. We might both agree that it is scandalous in appearance and imprudent, but I don't know if we could accuse him of idolatry given that. You also then mention a whole litany of saints that we have here in the post-conciliar era for the popes. I do have some reservations about sainting literally every single post-conciliar pope. It just seems a little conspicuous, but at the same time, it is within the authority of the church to do so. Papal canonizations are also infallible, by the way, so if you want to speak about heresy, you cannot be denying any of these because they are infallible instances. But yeah, whether or not they're the most prudent, I don't know. I do have some questions there.
All right. I want to go back to you. I want to get your response. What do you think? Mike? No? All right. All right. Nothing, I guess. Did I go to the wrong line? Oh, I went to the wrong line. Oh, no. Oh, he's not there anymore. Oh, that's why I went to the wrong line. No. He's not there. I just want to emphasize one thing that you said. You can't blame the Second Vatican Council for all of this. And part of the evidence of that is that virtually every religion in the West has suffered a breakdown in attendance. So sometimes people say, well, you know, we've lost all this mass attendance. Well, look what's happened to Methodists. Look what's happened to, you know, you can fill in the blank. And so the church, I mean, the world went wild after the 1960s and a lot of people stopped going to church. Anything you want to give us before we go, Michael? You just got a few seconds.
That's it. No.
Okay. All right.
I hear the music.
Yeah. Would you say again the piece that you recommended at Word on Fire, though, just so if people want to follow up with more education on the Second Vatican Council, they can go to
Dr. Richard DeClue on YouTube. Type in Dr. Richard DeClue Vatican II. It will come right up.
All right. And people can go to reasonandtheology.com to find out more about you and your work. Is that right, Michael?
That's it.
All right. I appreciate you. I really do. I feel like this was a big success. I like these ones where people get to air some of the laundry. Do you enjoy that, or is that stressful?
That's my bread and butter.
Okay, because I want to do this again. I want to talk about
let's do it.
The Second Vatican Council again. We'll let more people come on. But that does it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.